You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life.
Welcome to another episode of Fire and Chill with Pat and Dave. Today we're going to talk about, we're going to take a big picture overview of money and how we interact with it. And we're going to share a number of lessons that Pat and I have learned over the years that we found have been the most important when it comes to personal finance and building wealth. And there's a few reasons that this topic is important, especially just as we're starting the podcast. Like we said, these lessons have been incredibly helpful for us and we just want to pass them on to you. It'll also help set the tone of the show and it'll make it easier for you guys to understand where we're coming from when we talk about other topics and really get into the details. It also builds a great foundation for newbies and anyone getting started, but it also reinforces old lessons that are important for the diehard personal finance enthusiasts. We've found that this stuff is absolutely critical when it comes to building wealth and especially if you want to retire early. So it's really important that we cover it pretty early in the show. So those are a few reasons. What else do you reckon, Pat?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that more than just lessons, we think that these are the absolutely critical foundational blocks of being able to build wealth. So it's not just, oh, these are a few money lessons. Me and Dave both believe that you need these foundational pieces so that building wealth is actually possible in your life. And these aren't like little gimmicky, you know, this is how you save money or this is it. These are, you know, the very big picture items that you need to get down pat early on. Otherwise, you're very likely to be stuck on a finance treadmill for most of your life. So I suppose we'll get straight into these lessons. Dave, what do you think? Do you want to start with the first one here?
Yeah, sure. So when people start down the, I guess, the finance, personal finance and wealth journey, there's a real temptation to think that the way you get wealthy is some huge payoff from some lucky investment or, you know, people winning lotto and stuff like that. That's the type of stuff that flashes in people's minds.
Yeah, they think you have to have wealthy parents, you have to inherit some money.
Exactly.
No one gets wealthy unless they've got really lucky.
Yeah, exactly. But the most important lesson for me from what I've read and from what I've experienced is that saving is what builds wealth more than anything.
Yes, absolutely.
And that might sound a little bit boring, but it's far more powerful than that. I think saving is the real foundation of building any sort of meaningful wealth, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. So I like to think that when you're thinking of the word wealthy, what comes to mind? And what may come to mind is fancy houses, fancy cars, etc. But when you drive in onto the word wealth or financial wealth in this case, what we're really talking about is how much money you have on the sidelines, not how much you're spending. Because if you bring in, you know, $300,000 a year, but you're spending $300,000 a year, then at the end of 1 year, your wealth is exactly $0. So income actually doesn't, or spending doesn't dictate someone's wealth. What actually dictates someone's wealth is the amount they're able to save and put aside.
Mm. So to put that pretty simply, if a dollar comes in and a dollar goes out, you're no better off than before.
That's right. You're not wealthy.
No, exactly. And the thing about saving is it's, especially in modern day Australia, our incomes are relatively good compared to the rest of the world. So saving is much more within our control than other factors that build wealth. If we save money today, it's there tomorrow, you know, it's there at our disposal to invest or to use however we like. And we can repeat that process over and over.
Yeah.
So without saving in the beginning, like wealth's just going to escape you. It'll always prove elusive.
Correct. And saving is something that almost anyone can do. It's not someone who has to be in a special circumstance or someone who has to have some sort of special gift or inheritance or, as we said before, some lottery win or someone who has to be in a super high income job. Saving is something that almost every single one of us here can do right from today. So it's not a special thing that's only a small proportion of people are capable of pulling off. It's something that all of us can do.
Mm. And when we link it back to things like financial independence, a lot of people are surprised when they learn that saving actually provides the bulk of your portfolio in over, say, 10 or 15 years. It's not actually investment returns. We can link to some calculators in the show notes that show how this is the case. And that was pretty surprising when I first learned, and I know it is the same for other people too. They think, well, you know, if you get X return, then that's where the wealth's going to come from. But it's really from that consistent level of saving month after month for a period of like many years.
Yeah. Well, the investment returns and the compound growth are only really make up a larger proportion of your portfolio. As you said, after 20, 30, 40 years, that's when that engine will really turn and bring the wealth to you. But when you're doing something like what you or I are doing, which is trying to save up a lot of money in a very short period of time and achieve FIRE, it's actually almost entirely your savings that are going to build that bedrock. And from that bedrock, the investment returns will come.
Mm. I think some people find that a little bit frustrating because they want the, I guess they've been convinced that they want the investment returns to do the heavy lifting. But really, when you've got a 10-year goal or even a 15-year goal, it's really the saving that's going to do the trick. And rather than find that discouraging, I find it motivating because, like we were saying before, you have more control. You have way more control over how much you save versus how much investment returns you're going to get.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose when you are investing, like you said, people can get quite frustrated. But the truth is you only really start to notice the compounding effect well into the whole savings journey. When you save your first 20, 30, 50 grand, the investment returns make up, like we're saying this again, just a tiny proportion year on year. Mm. It's only when you get into the hundreds of thousands that you really start to see that money coming in year after year in a significant amount.
Yeah. So what else? What's the next lesson you want to share, Pat?
Well, this is one that I think both of us like to talk about a lot, Dave, and that's the wealth illusion. So this is the, you know, you're going about your daily life and you're seeing people in the, you know, Ralph Lauren polo shirts and they're in the Maseratis or they're in the Lexus cars or they have like big four-bedroom houses. And we all assume that those are the wealthy people. But especially since I started looking into wealth and reading things and listening to YouTube and other FIRE podcasters and blogs, you begin to see it all in a new light. This many people around you can't be that wealthy. It's like, it must be an illusion. And it is an illusion. And it's all based on the easy availability of credit and debt. And so these people have just built these lives, this sort of deck of cards based on this mountain of debt. And we like to say the wealth illusion is actually you peel back the illusion and you see a reality of huge debt. And it's not necessarily everything that it appears to be from first glance.
Yeah, like having having a super expensive lifestyle has almost nothing to do with wealth.
Yes. Well, you could pull it off today. I could pull it off today. You know, we could both be driving Maserati. How much does a Maserati cost? I don't know.
I have no idea. I haven't bought one in a while.
No. We could both be driving Teslas tomorrow, and we could both possibly be living in gigantic four-bedroom houses on the beach, but that would all just be built on a mountain of debt and not an actual reality of wealth.
Mm. Like, we're not just making this up here that, you know, people who look wealthy maybe aren't wealthy. There was actually a famous study done that a number of you might have heard about it before. It was illustrated in a book called The Millionaire Next Door. And it was written by two authors who spent 20 years studying the history and the details of US millionaires to find out all the details about them. And they found some very, very interesting things. Most of them didn't have wealthy parents. They actually lived in typically average suburbs. And most of them drove like a modest secondhand car. But the thing that made them millionaires was that they had a strong habit of managing their finances well and saving and investing on a regular basis.
Yep.
And another funny thing was I was actually born in Scotland and they broke down the millionaires in the book by background. And so they had a little section in there about Scottish millionaires. And so they had it in there that on average, the Scottish millionaires built the same amount of wealth on lower incomes. And that was suggesting that they were like extra frugal, which is the famous like the famous line about tight-fisted Scottish people. So it made me laugh.
Yeah, so that is surprising, you know, to a lot of people. I don't think it's surprising to you or me at this moment, but you'd seem to think that once someone has made their millions, they wouldn't have any qualm with going out and buying a brand new car. But once you've spent all those years building those habits of saving and investing, the thought of going out and just blowing it on a brand new car of any description, it will often be that those sorts of people won't be able to do that anyway after building those decade-long habits. So,
and they probably see it in the way of, like, they see it in the sense of, what's the point? Like, I'm already living a satisfying life, so what do I need a 100 grand car instead of a 10 grand car?
Yep.
It's not like they actually don't feel like they're missing out on anything.
Yeah.
So I really like this book, and like you said before, it gets you to see things in a new lens. And I remember reading it once or twice, and my real takeaway from the book was that I kind of distilled it down into one line, and it was like, wow, there's a group of people who spend most of their time trying to look rich when other people are just becoming rich. So we kind of have one choice. We can spend our money and efforts in looking or acting rich, or we can actually become rich. So it's like a case of, well, which one do you want to be?
Well, you know? Yeah, you can look rich. Perhaps we can create this whole illusion where in our own little community, it's the people that look the poorest that we now associate with being richest.
Yeah, you kind of flip it on its head and assume the opposite.
Well, I don't know what to believe anymore. I was out going for a jog the other day, and I saw this other bloke, and his shirt was in tatters. Like, there must have been like a dozen holes in it. And I'm like, well, I don't know. That guy might be the richest guy on the street. Who knows?
Yeah, well, that's right. You never know, do you?
No, it's all...
It's definitely not what you assume. That's the underlying theme.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But then this brings up another thing. Like what you were saying before, you know, once they've built this wealth, why don't they go out and buy a fancy car? And why don't they go out and upgrade to a more flash suburb? And I was kind of suggesting that they're probably already living a satisfying life. So there's probably some people that are wondering, like, but aren't they missing out? Wouldn't it be better to have both?
Mm.
And that kind of leads into our next lesson. Mm. And that is, you don't need lots of money and an expensive lifestyle to live a happy life.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is probably, I suppose some people may believe that the whole point of building wealth is eventually doing all those things, having the really nice car and the really big house and all of that. But really, the goal here is to lead a happy and satisfying life. What do you think, Dave? This is...
Well, it gets tricky here because you fall into the trap of thinking that more is better. Or like more luxury, or more holidays, or more this, or more that. Or you think expensive is better and more is better. So once you start escalating your standard of living, it becomes like a never-ending pursuit.
Yeah.
Because you think that it's just, I don't think it's the best place to spend your energy.
No, definitely not. There will always be more. There will always be more. You'll never be the richest. You can always get a slightly bigger house and a slightly better neighborhood. You can always just get a slightly better car. You can always get a slightly better gadgets, go to slightly fancier restaurants. That ladder, there's no top of that ladder. That ladder keeps going.
And that's the treadmill like you were talking about before, and that's what a lot of people are on right now.
Yeah. And it's funny because it really never ends, because in every aspect of your life, there's always something better to have. You know, you can have slightly better furniture. Oh, your kitchen's a bit outdated. You can update your kitchen slightly. Oh, the car is getting a bit old now. You can update that. And then it just circles back on itself. 10 years down the track, the kitchen's outdated again, and you can update that. And now the coffee table's outdated again. And you can update that again. And you just keep going around in circles. And, you know, where's the end? I don't know. It's up to every single person to decide for themselves.
Like, I think we've been convinced that you need to always be upgrading things in your life. I guess advertising plays a big role in that.
Yeah.
But we do see people, like, if we just think for a minute, people 50 years ago didn't have half the luxury that we have now, and they seem to live contented lives. You know, it's not like everyone's much happier now than they used to be. I think, if anything, the opposite is probably true. Life's gotten a lot more complicated and, yeah.
Well, it's like these this laptop I'm talking to you on right now. I'm not really sure when we bought this laptop, but it still does everything we need to. Honestly, I think it might be about half a decade old now, but here we are. I'm talking to you on Skype. I could get a fancier looking one, but why? It does everything I need. Yeah.
Exactly. I think mine's about 5 or 6 years old too. But yeah. Hey, it does the job, so who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
But once you start, I guess once you step away from this hyper-consumption trap, you start to see things in a different light again, and you start to question where everyone spends their money trying to pursue more and thinking it's going to make them happier when that probably isn't the case. So when you do step back from that and start to question things, it does help you save more, because you realize, okay, I probably don't need that new thing. I probably don't need this, you know, extra holiday or upgrade the car or whatever. So your desires tend to start melting away.
Yep.
Yeah, and so your savings rate increases without you even really trying, just from you questioning things around you. And obviously that helps you build your savings and investment portfolio and retire much sooner than you otherwise would have.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Can it happen the other way around as well, though, Dave? Can you start to believe that less is more, and you start spiraling down out of control, and you're always getting less and less and less, and then you think it's going to make you happy, but is there a limit on the downside?
That's a good question. Maybe. Well,
intuitively, there has to be a limit. You know, you can't go without food and shelter. So we have one.
Aren't monks some of the happiest people on earth, though?
I don't know. Are they?
From what I've read, they seem to be pretty content.
Yeah, okay. I've not read anything about monks, so maybe okay. You're right.
Like, I know personally, as we, like, when I met my partner, we both had ideas of living a more luxurious lifestyle than we do now, like a more consumer-based lifestyle. Like, we both had a certain car we wanted to buy, like, in the future when we built wealth. It was more of about building wealth, and later we'll enjoy those. Yeah. Well, not all of it, obviously, but we'll upgrade our lifestyle later as our wealth builds.
Yeah.
But over the years, those desires have pretty much faded away, as I've realized that it's not going to do anything for us, really. Like, we can get it, but, like, what for?
And do you think that's a natural thing as you get older, or is that just specific to sort of your situation or people who are necessarily trying to build wealth and retire early?
I'm not sure. I think when you are trying to build wealth, there is that period where you do step back and, like, okay, well, we won't buy this or this. And then over the period after that, like, say, 5 years or whatever, when you do start saving more aggressively, you realize you're not less happy for it. So then you think, oh, like, I'm not actually feeling like I'm missing anything.
Yep.
So why would I then go and upgrade
all this
lifestyle later?
Yeah. It's like I was saying before, you build those habits for so long that they don't just go away once you hit a magic number. Those habits are there, and sometimes they're there forever.
I guess living a less expensive life is built on habits just like a more expensive life. So it's not any harder, it's just different.
Yeah.
And once those habits are in place, it's all automatic. So it's not like a conscious decision like, oh, I'm going to miss out on this today. It's just like, you're just living your normal life, so.
Yeah, that's right. And I've always found it a bit funny, because that's exactly the way you preserve your wealth as well as build it. But when someone comes into a lot of money, like a lottery win, I've seen all of those news articles where 3 or 4 years later or whatever it may be, those people that have won the lottery, they're back at work. They've lost all of those lottery winnings and they now have nothing to show for it. And I suppose that's because they didn't spend the 10 or 15 years learning the habits required to build that level of wealth. Yeah. They just came about it with their own habits that they'd acquired before winning it. And those habits were not conducive to building or preserving wealth whatsoever.
Mm. And I think it's probably that in combination with like a taste for high consumption. Like, obviously they had an underlying urge that, oh, if I had the money, here's what I'd do with it, you know? Like, you hear about people, it's almost like a joke where people at work would say, You know, if you're going to win lotto, what are you going to do with it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people are, oh, I'd buy this and this and this.
Yeah, yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? So they already have, like, these underlying urges to spend it before they've even got it. So then what, the people that do win lotto,
yeah,
you know, they've already spent it before the checks hit the bank account.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they've already got these underlying consumer desires.
Whenever anyone asks me that question, it's like, yeah, 100% in, yeah, 99.9% share market, like 0.1% a burrito or something.
And they just roll their eyes and turn to the next person.
Yeah, that's right.
But I guess if we step back and think about why that's the case, it's probably because people think, well, those things are going to make me happier. Otherwise, why would they do it?
Yeah, like you said, turning that on its head and understanding that you don't need money to live a happy life is where you can really start to make that change. If you can really start to really not just know, but believe that spending money won't bring you any more happiness. And taking it one step further is not spending money and then down the track using that money to buy back more of your freedom, to do more of the things that will actually bring you happiness. It's a very
Exactly. So if you got to spend it on something, why not spend it on, you know, getting your life back rather than anything else? You're going to have more satisfaction with than anything you could buy.
Well, precisely.
Having your freedom.
Yeah.
So I had this little quote that I had on my blog a little while ago. There's an old saying that, you know, time is money. But I kind of flip that on its head and I think to myself, money is time. Because the more money you have, the more time you can buy for yourself.
Yeah.
Like all these little chunks of money that we're saving up can be used to redeem free time in the future.
Yeah.
So if we save up enough of it, we can redeem all the time that people are currently working.
Yeah. And that's really what we're hoping to do here, was saving up money to redeem time in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's what I'm still doing. You're... You've done that.
If we just put another bit in this section, have you noticed, I don't know if you've, have you simplified your lifestyle at all, and have you noticed any decrease in happiness as a result? Because personally, I think I half said it before, but we used to spend almost twice as much as we do today when we first met, and my partner, and it just came down and down and down over the years. And we're definitely no less happy today than we were before.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll say, like, when I first was starting my career and starting to get a lot of disposable income, I suppose I was just a touch more careless with my money than I am now. And so I never went out and, like, spent all of it. That was just never within my psyche. There was always some being put aside. But no, yeah, I haven't. Now that I spend less than what I did before, I haven't really noticed. I can't even think of what I used to spend it on.
Yeah, that's the crazy part, right? You start to wonder where it all goes.
I'm just trying to think now. Yeah. Like, obviously, I took several overseas holidays, and I still have while I've been saving for FIRE. But I don't know, I've never been too enamored with fancy brand name clothing. I've never, so I don't even know. But I think I'd always spent like less money. I think maybe I just bought gadgets and electronics a bit more than I do now, and maybe video games a bit more than I do now.
It's funny because you say that you don't know where exactly it went, and some people don't agree with me on this point, but I think it's not, like, there's an argument that it's always the big ticket items that's where it goes. And to some extent, that's true because those are the big ticket items we spend on. So that would be housing, car, food, whatever. But I'm still convinced that a huge portion of it is all the other categories as well, all the little bits and pieces. Like, if you spend fractions more or less in every category that where you spend money, it adds up to a huge amount over your whole, I guess, your whole budget or your whole yearly spending. So it's probably more a philosophy or an attitude or the way you approach things than anything else.
Yeah, I think you're right. But there has to be some sort of a trade-off. So I'd like to say that those big ticket items, they're easy to just sort out and then never think of ever again. And then you can just go about your days. Whereas those smaller items, they're presented to you, you know, 5-10 times a day. And you have to be on top of them until you've built some sort of habits. And maybe you don't want to build those habits. Maybe you just want to be careless with getting a coffee daily or something. And that's fine as well, if that's important to you. With the housing and the transportation and the food, once you've chosen your housing and once you've chosen your mode of transportation, those savings are just taken care of. You don't need to rethink about them. You don't need to, you know, every day you wake up, you have to think about how much you're spending on housing. It's just there. It's done. So I suppose that's one of the reasons taking care of those big ticket items is so powerful, because it doesn't require constant, you know, application of the principles.
Yeah. All right, shall we move on to the next lesson?
Yeah. So now we've found out how to build wealth and why spending money isn't necessarily needed for a happy life. But what are we going to do with all this wealth, Dave? What happens with it?
Well, after we've bought our Maserati, like you mentioned before, mate, we're gonna invest the rest.
Yes.
Now we're gonna invest it. So this leads to our next lesson, which we kind of spoke about before, and that's the power of compound interest. And so even though we said that saving is probably more important over a time frame like 10 years or 15 years, compound interest is still a massively important personal finance lesson to learn in terms of building wealth. And so everybody's probably heard about it, but I think a lot of people still struggle to really understand how it works, because it's not something that is, I think it's not something that comes naturally as a thing to wrap your head around. But I think once you do kind of get it, and once you do understand it, it's hard not to see things the way you saw them before. So it'll affect your mind, and it definitely did for me when I first learned about this. I can't remember which book it was in, but it might have been an old Noel Whittaker book about building wealth. I can't remember the name. But it was just a basic compound interest table, and it just showed how if you invest, I don't know, $10,000 or something, and you're getting a 7% return, it'll double after 10 years. And so you think, oh, that's pretty cool. But then you look at this table and it goes 10,000, 20,000, 40,000, you know, and it doubles every 10 years. And you look at it over the course of maybe, I don't know, 60 years, and it's just the number blows out astronomically because it just doubles each time. And not that investments are that consistent year after year or whatever, but the principle is the powerful part to learn. And I remember just staring at the page for like a couple of minutes, just like, oh my God, is this real or what? I couldn't believe it.
Well, I've been trying to relate the current pandemic to compound interest a lot when I'm trying to explain it to people, because kind of stupidly, I think people understand compound interest. So I try and explain the pandemic in terms of compound interest. But I should realize that compound interest is no more intuitive than the scariness of this pandemic. But it's the same concept. It's small things can grow very quickly and very large over a period of time based on the fact that the same concept of exponential growth compound interest.
So this is basically the lesson of the principle of money earning more money by itself, and you're not having to do anything for it. So this is exactly how the rich get richer, with basically no effort of their own. They just own assets that compound over time.
Yeah. Once you've built that foundational block, which we were talking about in the first step, which is the 10 to 15 years of hardcore savings, once you've got that, you know, compound interest really takes over, and hopefully it gets to a point where the amount of growth is so much more than you can contribute to the portfolio that the main driver is the investment returns and not necessarily what you're saving. But it just takes a little while to get there.
Yeah. So even if we take a small example of someone saving, say, $500 a month, and they do that and earn an investment return of like 7% per annum, that's not a huge amount of saving, but that becomes $1.2 million after 40 years. And so that's probably someone's time frame to regular retirement. But what if you were saving $500 a week, not $500 a month, or even $1,000 a week if you're a couple or something like that? Yeah. It goes astronomical, you know?
I mean, and we're obviously aiming for this early retirement piece, this FIRE piece. But if you were saving that much and you actually just worked a regular career, which is roughly 30-ish years, you'll be like a multi-millionaire by the time you reach regular retirement. So it really is quite a powerful concept to try and get your head around, compound interest.
So I think the point is for people to start saving and investing as soon as they possibly can. And in the future, they'll be very glad that they did.
Well, that very first $1,000 you saved when you were 20, by the time you're 70, that thing will have, you know, grown to 20 or 30,000. I mean, I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, but those are the sorts of...
I guess the sort of multiplication and the doublings that we're talking about. It's really hard to yeah. wrap your head around.
But it does happen and it does grow. Yeah.
But it's like magic. I think it seems like magic, don't you?
No.
Did you not have that moment like I did where you're like, holy
here
shit.
It goes.
Do you remember when you first learned
about
it?
No, I can't remember when I first learned about it. It must have been at school, surely. No,
I didn't see that at school, man.
Oh, okay.
I wish I did.
I don't know. I think I did.
Maybe I just wasn't paying attention.
Maybe. I can't remember when I first learned about it. I definitely didn't learn about it in the concept of investments. I would have learned about it as a generic thing in mathematics at some point.
So let's move on to the final lesson for today.
Yeah. Your level of spending often dictates your freedom. So what we mean by this is when the more you spend or the more that you're required to spend, that actually detracts from your freedom from this whole rat race, I'll call it. So if you have a lifestyle that costs $100,000 a year, then you need $100,000 coming in each and every year just to maintain your lifestyle. And so that's a way in which your level of spending is controlling you rather than you controlling your spending.
Exactly. I mean, it's fine for people to say, yeah, okay, but that's my choice. That's my choice. Mm. But in a way it is, but in a way it isn't. Like, they have no choice. If they want to keep living that lifestyle, they're forced to keep going to work and earning that high income just to stay afloat and pay for that.
Mm.
But whereas for the lower spending person, that's not much less is required of them. So the less they spend, the less they need to work, and the much sooner they can control their time.
Yeah. And I suppose the most easy example to think of this in terms of is I see a habit of lots of people. When they go out and they decide they want to buy a house to live in, they will literally go to the bank, find out their maximum borrowing power. Like, whatever the bank tells them, they're like, okay, we're willing to lend you 700, 800, 1.2 million, 1.3 million. And almost without fail, every single person goes out and they go and find a house that they absolutely love, which is 105% of what the bank's willing to lend them. And they scrimp and try and make up that last 5% somehow to actually get the house that they want. And once they've done that, they are literally locked into a 30-year mortgage, which is the maximum service, their maximum serviceability that a lender would give them. And so they're trapped. They're trapped for 30 years doing that. And
it's funny, hey, because if you think about it, when they're given their maximum borrowing capacity, they go out and start shopping for houses that are at that much.
Yeah.
And let's say that they're probably fine houses, but they always want the one that's just a little bit out of reach, you know, just a little bit more expensive.
That's right. I've barely met a single person who hasn't done that. It's always just the max the bank's willing to lend them and a bit more. And somehow they just make it work. And it's very, very rare. I'll say in my personal anecdote, I'm not sure. I don't have statistics on this. For someone who the bank is willing to lend them $2 million, but they're just like, nah, I'll only buy a $600,000 house. You know?
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
No, it never happens. And that's just a very concrete example of how your level of spending controls your freedom. Because once you've got that loan, you have to make those repayments month after month. And if you don't, then your whole lifestyle just falls apart.
Mm. You're much more locked in at that stage. I mean, if you want to take a break from work or just switch to part-time, you've got absolutely no ability to do so with those higher level of expenses.
No. And back to this point you made where you was like, oh, well, that's my choice and I want to do that. Yeah, fair enough. You do want to do that right now. You know, are you going to continue to want to do that in 5 years? You're going to continue to want to do that in 10 years, in 15, in 20? And then they'll get onto this whole argument of like, oh yeah, by then I'll just sell the house. It'll be fine. I can downgrade. I can always reduce my lifestyle. And I think that's just a false belief, honestly. And as we're sort of finding out now, housing doesn't forever go up. There are, well, you've known this living in Western Australia for some time, but there's still this underlying belief in Sydney. I say it hasn't been eradicated yet that housing can never go down. But of course, that's not the case. If you decide in 10 years you no longer want that $2 million house, and now that $2 million house is valued at $1.8 million, well, guess what? You might not be able to just sell it because you haven't got enough equity to pay off the loan. So you 100% are stuck at that point. You have no choice.
And then I guess it brings back this point of what we were discussing. I think it was maybe in the last episode about workplaces workplace is changing, people's attitudes changing to the job that they're doing. They love it now, but in 5 years, 7 years, maybe they don't love it anymore. Yeah. Maybe that job's no longer available, you get laid off, whatever, you know what I mean?
Maybe so in a few years you have another child or another two children and you start to really begin to feel that their childhood years are getting away from you and you're not experiencing them. These things, I mean, it's not only the job that can change, you can definitely change, your circumstances can change, your all sorts of things.
Mm. So if we break this down into a couple of numbers, for every $1 of spending, we need about $25 of investments to cover that annual spending. And that's just assuming that our investments are going to provide us like a 4% per year for us to live on. You know what I mean? So
very rough numbers here. Very rough numbers.
Yeah. So for every $1,000, you're going to need $25,000 of investments to cover it in retirement. So reducing your spending has a massive advantage over trying to earn more income. And so that affects your freedom as well.
Mm, that's right. So if you have a $40,000 per year lifestyle, you only need roughly $1 million saved up to be able to support that $40,000 a year lifestyle. But if you have a $100,000 a year lifestyle, you need to keep working until you've saved $2.5 million, which is a much bigger task than $1 million, say. Mm,
makes a massive difference.
Yeah.
So even just switching your, changing your lifestyle by $5,000 a year or $10,000 a year makes a huge difference, like by hundreds of thousands of dollars of investments that you need.
Yes, exactly. And saving a few $100,000 of investments is no trivial task.
Mm. So that has a huge, again, that huge trade-off between how much you spend and how much freedom you have and how soon you can get that freedom.
Yep, exactly. So I think that's it. Do we have any more major foundational lessons we want to cover?
I think that's pretty much it for today. You touched on housing there, and I think we'll get into housing in a post pretty soon because that's a pretty juicy topic and always gets a lot of discussion here in Australia.
Yeah, definitely. I think you and I will just rant about it for an hour and then we'll stop recording.
Well, we'll enjoy it. Even if no one else does, we'll be having a good time.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so I think that's a wrap. We'll quickly go through those major lessons. Saving is what builds wealth, not spending and not income. It's how much you're able to put aside after you've earned your income. And then we went on to the wealth illusion. What you think is wealthy isn't necessarily what actually builds wealth. There is a lot of illusion out there with marketing and media and people presenting as wealthy when in fact that may not be the case at all. Number three, you don't need a lot of money to build a happy life. So again, with the marketing and the media and the peer pressure, it's often the case that it may look like having a really good life requires a lot of money. But time and time again, I think a lot of people have proven that incorrect, and you can prove that incorrect in your own life. If you just start spending a little less, a little less, a little less, you'll find that you're no less happy. In fact, you can actually build your happiness, especially if spending less builds up your security, because feeling insecure is a major source of stress for a lot of people. Once you've learned those first three lessons, compound interest is the generator, the engine that continues your wealth, preserves it, and continues to build it over time. And it's extremely powerful. And so compound interest is really what's going to make the big gains over your lifetime after you've built the foundational block of wealth through saving. Your level of spending often dictates the amount of freedom you have. If you have a very large level of spending and you've locked yourself into a very large level of spending, then it will be very hard to break free from the requirement to continue earning a very high income and continuing to work. Whereas if you have a low level of spending, you can really break free of the requirement to work full time all the time, work overtime, and you can really break away from that and get a more balanced life.
That's awesome. Awesome summary, Pat. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no worries.
So that's our top five lessons for personal finance and wealth when starting out on this financial independence journey. So thanks for listening to the show today. We're working on some more episodes, like we mentioned, so watch this space. Hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you did, leave us a review and let us know what you think. If you have topic suggestions or feedback, you can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And the show notes and anything we discussed in the show, like the calculators we mentioned, can be found on our blogs, Strong Money Australia and Lifelong Shuffle. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you guys soon.